for facilitated conversation throughout the city of Chicago. And starting tomorrow, we will also be presenting the Chicago premiere of a wonderful play at Victory Gardens Theater called Truth Serum Blues, a work that is a powerful indictment of the war on terrorism, torture, and the criminalization of communities that dissent. Tickets are almost gone, so please do not miss this important piece of art. I want to thank Heather Dalmage, the director of the Mansfield Institute for Social Justice, for co-sponsoring and providing the space for this event. Since its founding, Roosevelt University has pursued the mission of providing higher education to students of diverse racial, ethnic, and religious backgrounds. In a variety of ways, the university has attempted to apply the values of the two great Americans for whom it is named, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. The Institute for Social Justice, created in 1999 through a generous gift from the Mansfield Foundation, gives Roosevelt University a unique opportunity to develop an integrated program of curriculum, research, and outreach focused on social justice issues. Social justice studies is offered by the Mansfield Institute for Social Justice as a regular part of the academic curriculum at Roosevelt. And I also want to thank our other co-sponsor, In These Times magazine. In These Times is dedicated to informing and analyzing popular movements for social, environmental, and economic justice, to providing a forum for discussing the politics that shape our lives, and to providing and for producing a magazine that is read by the broadest and most diverse audience possible. In These Times has adhered to the belief that to thrive, a progressive political movement needs its own media to inform, educate, and orient itself. I also want to thank the staff of the Public Square and all of our volunteers, and to give a special thanks to Catherine Chandler, our events coordinator, without whom this wouldn't have been possible. She has her posse here, I guess. Now I want to introduce Susan Zesch, who is going to be moderating this event today. Susan Zesch is the director of the Human Rights Program and a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. As an attorney, teacher, and activist, Susan has worked on human rights, immigrants' rights, and social justice issues in Chicago and at the national and international level since the early 1980s. A graduate of the Chicago Public Schools, the University of Chicago, and the University of Michigan, she lives in Hyde Park with her son, Max Rothstein. Susan?
It is a great pleasure and honor to greet all of you this evening and to welcome Rashid Khalidi back to Chicago. Rashid is the director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University and author of a new book about to come out called The Iron Wall, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. His 2004 book, Resurrecting Empire, Western Footprints and America's Perilous Path in the Middle East, is now out in paperback, right, Rashid?
Mm-hmm.
And you can also still get copies of his earlier book, Palestinian Identity, The Construction of Modern National Consciousness. Professor Khalidi is past president of the Middle East Studies Association and was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation at the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations from October 1991 to June 1993. He's editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies and received his BA from Yale, his Dr. DPhil from Oxford University, and has taught at the Lebanese University, the American University of Beirut, Georgetown University, and 17 years at the University of Chicago. It is with a great deal of anticipation that Rashid's friends, colleagues, and members of the public here in Chicago welcome him back. We deeply miss his voice, which is one of the most important in the country on Middle East policy. As Palestinian, and as a historian, he has a deep understanding of the history of the region and all its peoples. Rashid is one of our best public intellectuals, and I don't need to say anything more because you came to hear him. I have to make one little announcement, which is that when we get to the question and answer period, and Rashid will just be up here at the podium and take questions directly, he's going to have to repeat your questions for the sake of the recording, because there isn't a recording mic out in the audience. This entire event is being recorded for broadcast by WBEZ as part of their Illinois Story series and will be available for broadcast, for download, and I think for podcasting for those of you who may want to take this talk to the beach in the summer. So without further ado, I would like to welcome back to Chicago Professor Rashid Khalidi.
I'm not entirely sure I like the idea of you listening to this talk I'm about to give by Lake Michigan this summer, so don't take that suggestion very seriously. It's always a pleasure to speak in Chicago. It's a great pleasure. It's an honor to be invited by the public square. It's a pleasure to be at Roosevelt University, but it's always a pleasure to speak in Chicago because I see so many people I know in the audience, including a large number of my students who I know are going to ambush me after the talk and talk to me about chapters of their dissertations. I have a grim topic to talk about today, unfortunately, which is another reason I don't think you want to take this to the beach with you. The topic is after elections in Israel and Palestine, what has changed? Let me begin by saying something general. As I speak to you this rainy afternoon here in Chicago, on the other side of the world, the Middle East is the scene of a number of humanitarian crises. Some of these crises are the focus of serious attention from our media and from our government, and some are not. In Darfur, hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians who have escaped the ravages of brutal Sudanese government-supported irregular forces and of ruthless rebel groups are suffering in huge refugee camps as the conflict still continues. Here, at least, partly because of media attention and with some belated intervention by the United States and the international community, a resolution may be in sight. In Iraq, there's another kind of humanitarian crisis. I just read this morning that electricity is down to 4 hours a day in Baghdad. If you've never lived in a city without electricity, which I've had the miserable fate to do, you can't even imagine what that's like. There is still not clean running water. There is still not proper sewage in the major cities. Health facilities are lacking. There's an absence of freedom of movement because of insecurity. All of this, as you know, is a result of the U.S. occupation, of the resulting insurgency, and of an emerging civil war between factions. All of this causing a level of suffering to the civilian population, especially in the big cities, that is almost as great as during the 10 years of U.S.-imposed sanctions. Here, also, there is at least some media attention, even if, partly because of the blunders of our government, no end is in sight to the misery of the Iraqi people. But in Palestine, where there is an impending humanitarian crisis, we are talking about a situation which, like the others, is entirely man-made and is entirely caused by politics. There, however, there is very little attention in the media, or by our politicians, or by our government, to the implications of this impending crisis, to its extent, or to its root causes. There are 3.5 million people in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip who today are on the brink of a total economic collapse. My nephew spoke to us the other day from Bethlehem. He said, the banks have no money. People have no liquidity. There is no money. Nobody is working. Nobody can get money from the banks. Bank transfers have basically stopped into the occupied territories or from the banks to people. This is a result of our government's actions. Moreover, as you may know, there is a situation where imports and exports have been frozen. I just heard today that the new Israeli defense minister has finally ordered the military to open the crossing into Gaza after 6 months during which it's been mainly closed, 5 months in which it's been mainly closed. All of this has taken place in violation of agreements that were worked out by James Wolfensohn, formerly the head of the World Bank, who negotiated at great length an agreement ensuring that crossings into Gaza would be kept open. They are closed. They have been closed for most of the past 5 months. And Wolfensohn, incidentally, has quit his job in disgust. There are shortages of medicine. There are shortages of milk. There are shortages of fuel. There are impending shortages of food. Now, I'm going to come back to this crisis, but I ask you to keep it in mind as I discuss the new political situation that obtains in both Palestine and Israel since the recent elections. Now, following these elections, a great deal has changed within both of these political systems. In Palestine, Hamas defeated Fatah, which controlled the Palestinian Authority since its formation 11 years ago, and which has dominated the PLO since 1968. This was a revolutionary change. After so many decades of hegemony, this was an ignominious defeat for Fateh, which garnered only 42% of the votes cast against 44% won by Hamas. Due to the nature of the electoral system, I'll come back to this, Hamas has gained a huge majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council. In Israel, the new Kadima party, formed by Ariel Sharon before his stroke in January, was humiliatingly defeated. The new Kadima party humiliatingly defeated the Likud party. Now, as you may know, Likud has dominated Israeli politics. It's been either the lead partner in or a partner in every Israeli government since 1977. Likud has now shrunk from being the largest party in the Knesset, which it has been since 1977, to being only the fourth largest. It only got 12 seats in a 120-seat Knesset. Kadima has since formed a government headed by former Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in coalition with Labor and other smaller Israeli parties. Now, I would say that there's little question that the internal changes that have resulted from these elections are undoubtedly the most sweeping in Palestine, even though they are important, I think, in Israel. In Palestine, in the occupied territories, Fatah has thoroughly controlled the entire executive branch of the PA since its formation. Although the president of the PA, Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, retained his post, and with his post he retained control over much of the executive branch, including some of the security forces, the new Hamas-controlled government is in charge of government ministries, including some of the security forces. It's not clear how this division of power will work out in practice, particularly in light of the current financial siege imposed on the Palestinian Authority and on the occupied territories by Israel, the United States, and the EU. In Israel, by contrast, although the constellation of power has definitely changed significantly with the eclipse of Likud, which was the party most associated with the settler movement. In fact, many people say that this vote is a resounding repudiation of the settler movement. And with the inclusion of the Labor Party in the government, in practice, not that much will change under the new Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert. As former Prime Minister Sharon's closest ally, Olmert was one of the leading architects of the policy of unilateral withdrawals, rejection of negotiations with the PA, and building a wall deep inside the West Bank, wall, barrier, fence, call it what you will, which Sharon initiated over the past few years. And in fact, Olmert campaigned explicitly on a platform of continuing this approach, and all signs are that he will do that. So even though it's a major shift, there is a great deal of continuity in Israel. I would say that, therefore, among these major changes, the most difficult phenomenon to analyze is the meaning of the rise to power of Hamas. I don't think anybody should have been surprised by the victory of Hamas in these elections. The past dozen years have witnessed widespread and growing animosity among Palestinians in the occupied territories against a political elite associated with Fatah that benefited the entire elite while Israel tightened its control over the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. Since 1991, when the so-called peace process began, when negotiations between Palestinians and Israelis started at Madrid and continued for a decade, in that period of 15 years, the settler population in the West Bank and East Jerusalem has more than doubled to over 450,000 people. Israel's occupation has become considerably more entrenched, and the movement of the entire Palestinian population of 3.5 million people has been drastically restricted as the population has been confined to small cantons by the wall, by closures. There are 700 or so checkpoints in different parts of the West Bank. Those things have basically locked down the entire population. The result, almost inevitably, was the inexorable political rise of Hamas. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at Hamas's core support in the consistent polling that's been done in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip over the past 15 or 16 years, its core support never went above about 25%. It ranged from about 10 to 15% at the low end to about 20 or 25% at the high. But it won these elections, and we have to explain that. And I think that it benefited from at least three important factors, and I'll bring up other reasons for its victory. The first is that Hamas has, since its founding in 1987, been providing extensive social services. In it, it builds on the tradition of the Muslim Brotherhood from which it grew, and it, in so doing, it was responding to a felt need as the population of the occupied territories grew more and more distressed economically. Secondly, I think that Hamas benefited from its reputation for honesty, incorruptibility, and competence in striking contrast with Fatah, which was renowned for its dishonesty, corruption, and incompetence. Thirdly, Hamas benefited from its critique of Fatah's failed negotiations with Israel and from its own reputation, that is to say Hamas's own reputation, for resisting the Israeli occupation after Fatah had said that it would renounce violence. Now, I have to stress, and this is something that all observers who looked carefully at these elections did stress, I have to stress that Hamas went to the people on the basis of a political program in these legislative elections, which was quite different from its charter of 1988. Now, that charter is a quite striking document. It is replete with anti-Semitic references. It rejects any negotiations with Israel in favor of armed struggle, and it calls for establishing an Islamic state in the entirety of Palestine, from the river to the sea, in place of Israel. Recognizing the limited electoral appeal to the broad masses of Palestinian voters of the uncompromising position that was embodied in this outmoded charter, Hamas hardly referred to its charter in the entire election campaign. Instead, it ran on a platform of change and reform. That was the slogan Hamas used. That was what was on its banners. It didn't talk about an Islamic Palestine. Didn't talk about any of the things that are in its charter. It talked about change and reform. Its electoral platform entirely downplayed its professed aims and basically focused on reforming the corrupt Palestinian Authority, providing social services to the people, and refusing to compromise on basic Palestinian national rights. It is striking that its very agreement to take place in these elections, held on the basis of the Oslo Accords, constitutes a major shift for Hamas. Hamas did not participate in the 1995 presidential elections. It did not participate in the Palestinian Legislative Council elections of the same year, and it refused to participate even in the 2005 presidential elections, claiming that doing so amounted to recognizing agreements made by the PA with Israel or the PLO with Israel, and therefore implicitly recognizing Israel. So this is a shift. The hardline Hamas Politburo, which is located in Damascus, vigorously opposed the movement's participation in these elections, but it was overruled by the leadership and the rank and file in the occupied territories. They said, we don't care if this is an implicit recognition of Israel, we feel that we ought to run, and they won. They won this internal debate. In the end, Hamas ran a well-organized electoral campaign. It benefited greatly from all of its advantages in what international observers, including President Jimmy Carter, recognized was a generally fair and free election. Obviously, Hamas benefited as well from the unpopularity and disorganization of its main rival, Fatah, about which I want to talk a little bit. The once hegemonic Fatah movement was thoroughly undermined in these elections by what Palestinians saw as its overly accommodating negotiating stance, but especially by its corruption and nepotism, and by its many failures in governance. The Fatah-dominated PA has been in existence since the mid-90s. In that time, it has failed to establish a constitutional system, it has failed to establish a rule of law, it has failed to provide basic public services, it has failed, though it has provided some, and it has failed to provide simple law and order for Palestinian citizens. Over many decades of dominance of the Palestinian political system, even before the PA was founded in the era of the PLO, Fatah got used to being the party in power. It enjoyed the perks of power far too much and grew out of touch with public sentiment in many regards. It's worth noting, however, that Fatah's political program of negotiating with Israel remained more popular than that of Hamas. You can see that in every poll. Most Palestinians still favor a negotiated settlement, even though they voted in their majority for Hamas or in a plurality for Hamas. But apparently, if you try and analyze this election result, Palestinian voters were trying to hold those who govern them accountable for their actions and judging them on the basis of their actions rather than their political programs. In a sense, therefore, this was an election in which Palestinian voters resolved to throw the bums out. Now, the underlying causes of disenchantment with Fatah and with their general situation on the part of Palestinian voters are not hard to discern. After a decade-long peace process, which ran from 1991 to 2000, and that was identified in the eyes of the Palestinian public with Fatah and with its leaders, with the late Yasser Arafat and the current president, Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen, Palestinians for the last 5 or 10 years have faced a more deeply entrenched Israeli occupation and were much worse off economically. The annual GDP per capita in the West Bank and Gaza Strip went down from about $1,300 a year in the late 1990s to under $1,100 in 2002-2003, and it has gone considerably lower since. It went down 30% in this year alone, and according to the IMF, it is probably below $700 now, from over $1,300 to under $700 a year per person. This amounts to a 50% reduction in GDP per capita in a little more than 7 years. This serious deterioration in the situation of ordinary Palestinians, even while the elite identified with Fatah prospered, in turn produced greater radicalism. This is not hard to understand. Ultimately, this deterioration on multiple fronts, not just the economic front, inability to move, the hopelessness of the political situation, all of these things, was one of the underlying causes of the shift in Palestinian public opinion away from Fatah to Hamas. If we were to ask, why did the Intifada start back in 2000, I would say, and why did the suicide bombings that characterized that Intifada, where did they come from? I would suggest that it was these same phenomena that drove both the shift away from Fatah and the Intifada and the suicide bombings. Unfortunately, the Intifada and the suicide bombings had among their many effects making Ariel Sharon the master of the Israeli political scene until his recent stroke, at least. Now, let me talk a little about Sharon and about Israeli politics, because much of what we're going to see under Olmert is going to be a fulfillment of the policies that were initiated by Sharon. Some of you may remember that our president called Ariel Sharon a man of peace. Many of us remember it. It was back in 2002. I would suggest that far from believing in the possibility of peace between Israel and its neighbors, the entire career of Ariel Sharon shows that he believed profoundly in its impossibility. Acting on that belief, starting in 1977 when he was Minister of Agriculture, then as Minister of Housing, and then as Minister of Defense, then as Prime Minister, Sharon probably did more than any other Israeli politician over the past 3 decades to foster the colonization of the West Bank by what are today over 450,000 Israeli settlers. He is probably more responsible than any other individual, than Prime Minister Begin, Prime Minister Shamir, or any other Israeli politician, partly because of his longevity in power. This process of settlement entailed massive land confiscation and eventually has led to the enclosure of most Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, at least, in what has amounted to a lockdown in their villages and cities. The creation of this archipelago of settlements all over the West Bank was consciously intended by Sharon to make it impossible to return large areas of that region to the Palestinians, and I would argue, therefore, to make an equitable peace with the Palestinians impossible. It may yet succeed in that objective, even though, strikingly, polls show that most Israelis are generally opposed to settlements in the occupied territories. Now, Sharon's refusal to negotiate seriously with the Palestinians from 2000, when he came into office, until he left the scene as a result of his stroke in January, and his unilateral withdrawal from Gaza last year, which he utterly refused to coordinate with the PA, refusing, in other words, to make it look like this was something the PA had achieved, and in effect making it appear that it was Hamas which forced Israel out of the Gaza Strip. All of this, in the end, reinforced Hamas and gravely undermined Abu Mazen in the years leading up to these recent elections. Abbas, I would argue, Abu Mazen, I would argue, has proven to be the most conciliatory leader the Palestinians have ever had. And I'm talking going back to the 20s and the 30s and right up to today. After 1 year of his presidency, Palestinians, who had voted overwhelmingly for him in elections in January 2005, right after Arafat's death, now gave Hamas a plurality of their vote, 44%. Fatah, as I told you, won 42% of the poll, and 4 smaller parties won the remaining 14%. However, Hamas won an overwhelming 74 of the 132 seats that were up in this election for the Palestinian Legislative Council as a result of the new electoral system that had just been instituted. Half of the seats in the Legislative Council were allotted according to proportional representation, and there Fatah got 42% and Hamas got 44%. But the other half were allocated in geographic constituencies where they were distributed on a first-past-the-post basis. So whoever got the most votes, even if there were five or six candidates, even if they only had 40 or 30 or 25%, won that district. This electoral defeat was also a result of a grievously bungled Fetteh electoral campaign. Fetteh allowed several candidates affiliated with it to run in the same geographic constituency in many cases, and therefore Hamas often won with less than the total Fetteh vote in some areas. It's clear, nevertheless, that voters were punishing Fetteh for its many failures in this election, but it is clear, in addition, that they were responding to a point that Sharon has forcefully impressed on them since the year 2000. And this point is that Israel would refuse to negotiate with them, no matter who led them, and no matter what their leader said. And the proof of this was the election of Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who could not get the Israelis to start negotiations. Why then vote for a party that was proposing to negotiate with the Israelis when the Israelis would not negotiate with them? In more than one sense, Hamas's victory is the consequence of this refusal. More profoundly, it's the logical result of decades of occupation. Now, this occupation, in, I think, 3 weeks, on the 7th of June, will enter its 40th year. 40 years. And it, not surprisingly, this is the core issue for Palestinians, at least Palestinians living under occupation. And it's the issue from which, for them, all else flows. I would point out to you, by the way, that this 39-year period amounts to more than two-thirds of the 58 years of the existence of the State of Israel. For two-thirds of its existence, Israel has been an occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and also the Golan Heights. This occupation involves a massive bureaucratic system that minutely controls the most important aspects of the lives of 3.5 million people. These include where they can and cannot go. It includes the issuance of identity papers, who can get them, under what circumstances. It includes where they can get an education, where they can go to work, where they can worship, whether and when they can visit a doctor, and so forth. The structural aspects of this occupation, in place for 39 years, mind you, its ubiquity, its longevity, and its intrusiveness in the everyday lives of all Palestinians are all little discussed in our media, especially on television, which is where we are told most Americans get their news, God help us. Moreover, this occupation, and this is even worse, is today barely mentioned by those who frame our country's foreign policy. These paragons hold not the 39-year-old occupation, but rather Palestinian violence to be the root of the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis, whence the focus in every document issued by this administration on Palestinian violence rather than on ending the occupation. Partly because of the obtuseness of our own government on this score, Hamas's victory in these elections did not endanger the peace process, as some commentators have mindlessly repeated. There is no peace process to be endangered, nor has there been one for 6 years, at least. How can there be a peace process when, for a number of years, really for a longer period than 6 years, Israel has been reinforcing rather than dismantling its occupation of the West Bank, and when for 6 years it has been willing only to take unilateral measures rather than negotiated measures, such as the withdrawal from Gaza? How can there be a peace process without negotiations between the parties, and when for several years Israel has negotiated only with the United States? This is precisely what Prime Minister Sharon did with President Bush during his last visit, I think it was, to Washington in April. No, actually, it wasn't his last visit, his last but one visit to Washington in April 2004, when President Bush assured Sharon in a formal letter that Israel's settlement blocks in the West Bank were, quote, realities, and that Palestinian refugees could not return to Israel in any peace settlement. It's worth dwelling, I think, for a moment on the significance of this letter and of the agreement between these two men reached in April of 2004. In accepting that Israel has the right to annex considerable areas of the West Bank occupied in 1967, where the largest of its illegal settlements are located, the president departed significantly from the policy of all six previous administrations since 1967. Since that year, U.S. policy had always maintained that settlements, all of them, are illegal and were an obstacle to peace. At one stroke, in fact, President Bush's father's administration issued a letter in which it said just these things. At one stroke, this Bush administration discarded one of the core principles of the sole internationally recognized basis for Arab-Israeli peacemaking, which is Security Council Resolution 242 of 1967. That principle is the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force. Now, illegal settlements have been described by our president as realities that will have to be taken into account in any agreement. Sharon's plan for a unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip while maintaining de facto control of the Gaza Strip from without, from the air, sea, and land, was grounded in these Bush-Sharon understandings. In coming to these agreements with Sharon, the Bush administration completely bypassed the Palestinians. They never talked to the Palestinians. Negotiating this supremely important matter for their future directly with the Israeli government, it was as if the Palestinians did not exist. Now today, things have changed. Today we have a Hamas government in power in Palestine. And today, in justification of the latest iteration of what I would suggest is an ongoing Israeli refusal to negotiate, a refusal which is supported by the United States, it's argued here and in Israel that there can be no negotiations until Hamas recognizes the existence of Israel. There's also an American demand that, and an Israeli demand that it meet a number of other conditions, including the cessation of violence and acceptance of all agreements signed between the PLO and Israel. And some, many Arab countries have agreed in making these demands on Hamas. Now, it is certainly true that Hamas does not recognize the existence of Israel. And indeed, according to the Hamas charter, it seeks to replace Israel with an Islamic state. Those of you who are older than 20, and I think most of you in this room probably are, who are older than 30 perhaps, a number of you maybe, whether you admit it or not, anyone who recalls the lengthy diplomatic dance from the mid to late 1970s until the mid-1990s that finally led to PLO-Israeli negotiations, and you will recall how much emphasis was placed on the PLO charter during that minuet that went on and on and on for decades. Those of you who remember this will find this Israeli trope and other similar songs about the absence of a partner, there's no one to talk to, will find these things all too familiar as an excuse not to negotiate seriously. The distinguished Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev reported in Haaretz in March that while former Israeli Chief of Staff Mordechai Gur, who was a very close advisor of Prime Minister Rabin, was watching the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords on the White House lawn in September 1993, he turned to the person sitting next to him and said, "This ceremony could have taken place 15 years earlier if Israel had not refused to negotiate with the PLO. As many Israelis have pointed out, one needs to negotiate peace with one's enemies, not with one's friends, with the people who don't recognize you rather than the people who do." Now, there is no question that Hamas's formal position on a settlement with Israel is even more hardline than was the position of the PLO in the early 1970s. And I can say flatly that there is a possibility that this position will not evolve. It may and it may not evolve. The first indications that there may be more flexibility than appears in this formal position came in reports in March when a Hamas delegation was received in Moscow for talks with the Russians and expressed a willingness to negotiate with Israel if Israel would agree to a complete withdrawal from the territories occupied in 1967. Since then, there have been numerous similar indications that Hamas may or may not be willing to negotiate with Israel and may or may not be willing to accept a two-state solution to the conflict if Israel withdraws from the entirety of the occupied territories. The most recent of these indications is an agreement that was signed earlier this month between leaders of the Hamas and Fatah factions in Israeli prisons, which is the place where Palestinians go to meet each other, Palestinian militants. And there are thousands of them there. And the factions in prison are the most important elements of both Hamas's organization and Fatah's organization. So Mustafa Barghouti and the leader of the Hamas prison faction came to this agreement, which suggested that both would work to a towards negotiations and a two-state solution to the conflict, the Palestinian state alongside Israel. Now, it's clear that while there are people in Hamas pushing for this, overtures like this have been opposed by other Hamas leaders, particularly some of the exiled leadership in Damascus, which indicates that there is clear internal opposition within Hamas to such flexibility. Nevertheless, there is a precedent, and a very important precedent, for this flexible position. The spiritual leader of Hamas, the late Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, and several other major leaders of Hamas who have also been assassinated by Israel, like Abdelaziz Arantisi and others, have repeatedly indicated before they were killed, that Hamas might conditionally accept a two-state settlement. The same thing has been said by the current prime minister, Ismail Haniyeh. They've said that such a settlement would be based on an extension and a strengthening of the current 16-month truce that everybody agrees, the Israelis and everybody else, Hamas has generally respected. In fact, Hamas has much more scrupulously respected this truce than have other factions, including Fatah and Islamic Jihad, which are responsible for most of the attacks in the past 16 months. In spite of terrorist atrocities, like the recent suicide attack in Tel Aviv, and in spite of Israeli attacks that have killed scores of Palestinians in the last couple of months, many of them civilians, this truce has produced a period with the lowest number of Israeli casualties since 2000. And this is largely the work of Hamas. So what these Hamas leaders say is that based on an extension and strengthening of this truce, they would launch an initiative directed at securing a long-term accord with Israel based on a complete withdrawal from the occupied territories. Such an accord, according to Hamas, would not involve a peace treaty, would not involve full recognition, but it would last for decades, and that thereafter peace would be possible. Now, I would not suggest that this appears to be a great deal to go on, but I don't think there was a great deal to go on with the PLO before negotiations with it were initiated either. I think it is important to look at where Palestinian public opinion is. We're talking about political factions, and political factions are important, but let's just quickly look at public opinion. Polling data, and indeed the PLC election results themselves, show that most Palestinians want a two-state solution. Most Palestinians do not want a war to the death with Israel, because they know it will mean mainly Palestinian deaths, and most of them want a secular political system. 56% of the votes in these parliamentary elections went to secular parties, Fatah and the other smaller parties. Many of those voted for Hamas clearly did so as a protest vote. My son was in Bethlehem at the time the elections took place. His Christian neighbors, who are not Islamists, who don't want an Islamic state, voted for Hamas. They voted as a protest against Fatah. They didn't vote for Hamas because they liked the beard of the late Abdelaziz Arantisi or the Islamist political program of Hamas. Hamas's main aim, since its founding in 1987, some people would argue it's the jihad against Israel. I would suggest that its main aim has been ascendancy in Palestinian politics, winning Palestinian politics, and it is now close to achieving this goal. Has it come this far, only to be cast back into the political wilderness by sticking to extremist positions that were enunciated nearly 20 years ago in the Hamas Charter and that everybody knows are rejected by most Palestinians? There are clearly Hamas leaders, and much of the rank and file, who want to go in an entirely different direction. It is possible that under pressure of its exiled leadership and other hardliners, under pressure of external forces, Hamas may make a decision to stick to its old position. If it does so, in the long run, Hamas will fail spectacularly, because this position will be rejected by its own people. However, I want to conclude by saying that whatever Hamas does, and there is a choice for Hamas here, an important choice, much of what will happen in this conflict is up to others. And I want to end by talking about that. Specifically, will the two most powerful states in the Middle East help or hinder such a potential evolution, if in fact it's possible? These, of course, are the United States and Israel. Israel, as we know, is the occupying power, with ultimate control over absolutely everything that takes place between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. There is a Palestinian authority that has no sovereignty, no jurisdiction, no control, and in fact exists as a sub-agent, essentially, of Israel. It has no independent power or authority. Israel is the occupying power. Israel controls pretty much everything important between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. The United States, as we all know, is Israel's indispensable international enabler and is the world's sole superpower. Israel's actions in the West Bank over many decades, endorsed fully by our government and by repeated administrations, I would suggest have produced the moment we are in. As a general rule, I don't think this is a terribly revolutionary statement, occupation breeds resistance, and prolonged occupation breeds extremism. In the cases of Palestine and Iraq, occupation has bred radical Islamism. I don't know why anybody should be surprised. While no one can predict the future, and I never do that, a good bet would be that in both cases, more occupation will breed more extremism. I'm not making a prediction. I'm simply saying that if we look at the present and the past, that would be what we might guess might happen. Now, the current policy of Israel and the United States towards Hamas appears to me to have two main elements. The first is to try and starve the Palestinian Authority financially with a view to creating a humanitarian crisis deliberately, causing further misery among the 3.5 million Palestinians under occupation deliberately in order to bring down the Hamas-led government. The idea in Washington apparently is that a pliable Fatah government will then step in to take the place of Hamas, which will be repudiated by the starving Palestinians. The second element of this policy is to refuse to engage constructively with a PA which is run jointly by a Fatah president and a Hamas-led cabinet with a view to exploring whether a just and lasting settlement is in fact possible between Palestinians and Israelis now. It seems to me that this policy is destined to fail. And if our country and Israel continue to follow such a course, it will be they and not the people who are suffering under occupation who will be mainly responsible for the consequences that will inevitably follow, including whatever humanitarian crisis may occur. The first element of this policy, the idea of starving people, may in fact already be crumbling under the pressure of rational elements in the Israeli government, like the new defense minister, labor leader Amir Peretz, the EU, which has finally dissented from the madness out of Washington, and the United Nations, which has feebly begun to protest what is happening in the occupied territories. All of them, and most observers anywhere else but the United States, including many people in Israel, recognize that starving the Palestinians by cutting off the money going to the 130,000 Palestinians who work for the PA, who feed a total of 29% of the population of the occupied territories, who are dependent on these salaries, will only cause further radicalization and can only cement popular support for Hamas. If Fatah goes along with this, Fatah will be seen as a bunch of quislings. They will not come to power, I promise you, as a result. I would ask you, moreover, to consider this question in light of whatever you may know about Palestine and Israel. Since when has squeezing the Palestinian people produced moderation? The Israelis, you may have noticed, have been trying this approach at least since the beginning of the Second Intifada in September 2000. Immiserating the entire population of the occupied territories, whose GDP, I've just told you, has gone down 50%, closing off the whole region, locking people down, not to speak of military pressure. We've seen the result. The result is a Hamas-dominated government, not more moderation. Nevertheless, this policy, irrational though it seems to me at least, is still in place and may produce consequences that will not only be dire for Palestinians, or for that matter, for Israelis. Our country's unpopularity in the Middle East, in the Islamic world, and indeed in much of the rest of the world, is directly tied to our policies in Palestine and Israel, as well as our policies in Iraq. We are seen by most people around the world as the enablers of an Israeli occupation that has gone on for two full generations, and as the occupiers of Iraq. We are particularly resented in the Middle East for both of these things. The consequences of our policies will not just be felt by Palestinians or Israelis or people in the Middle East. They will also be felt by Americans who work or study or travel in that region or who may have to fight there or who are currently doing so. Our policies impact our soldiers in Iraq and in other parts of the Middle East. I would suggest that these are issues of great consequence, not only for the Middle East, but also for Americans and for the American national interest. Unfortunately, these issues are rarely sanely debated in the United States, especially not on Capitol Hill. Instead, what we most often get there is deference to executive power, heated rhetoric about terrorism without any thought about what it involves, and knee-jerk support for the most extreme Israeli position, and indeed for positions that are sometimes more extreme than those taken by Israel. This is the case, for example, with legislation that is currently before our august House of Representatives and our even more august Senate. The House bill, which is by far the worst of the two, though they're both awful, describes the entire occupied Palestinian territories, which I would remind you are an area under Israeli control. Israel is the occupying power. But under the House and Senate bills, the occupied territories are described as terrorist sanctuaries. Certain consequences kick in once that bill is passed into law, if it is. If it becomes a law, it means that transfer of money there to individuals, to charities, to NGOs, or for other purposes could be liable to criminal or civil prosecution here in the United States. If you send money there, if this bill is passed, you could be prosecuted. It is a terrorist sanctuary. Beyond that, an amendment to the House bill moved by a congressman in New York, whose name I won't mention, an amendment to the House bill would shut down the PLO office in D.C. and the PLO observer mission at the United Nations. Very constructive act, that. Even the Israeli government does not propose such radical steps. And it doesn't do this for very good reason. It understands that as the occupying power in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and this was the decision of the legal advisors of the foreign ministry, they told the Israeli government, whatever happens in Gaza, we're still the occupying power. If the PA collapses, we are responsible. As the occupying power in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, Israel is ultimately responsible for the populations under occupation and therefore would be responsible for any humanitarian catastrophe that ensued if draconian measures like this were allowed to take force. It's also opposed to this bill because Israel still maintains contact with the PA and the PLO, even though it refuses to negotiate with them. I would suggest that this is another instance of Capitol Hill being more royalist than the king, under the impulsion of pressure from a lobby that claims it supports Israel, but is in fact far more extreme in many of its positions than Israeli public opinion or even the Israeli government. I would suggest that you all ascertain the position of your senators and congressmen and women on these measures and let them know how you feel about them. I'm going to conclude by saying this. Only when analysts and experts are able to tell their political masters, the people we elect to be in charge of our government, without fear of retaliation, about the high costs of policies that ignore U.S. interests, ignore international law, and ignore international public opinion, only when they can talk freely to their bosses, and only when ordinary citizens in this country can tell their representatives in Congress that they oppose such policies, will we have a chance of getting it right with respect to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Maybe the election of Hamas, which represents for Palestinians in some ways the end of the world as we know it for decades, maybe this will provide the wake-up call. Unfortunately, in view of what I've seen happening in Washington over the past 6 years at least, I am not terribly optimistic. Today, the Bush administration is continuing its war on expertise within the bureaucracy and without. It continues to prefer to appoint and promote in the military, in the intelligence services, and in the State Department on the basis of loyalty and ideological purity rather than service and achievement. And we have some very talented people in those three branches of government. Congress, meanwhile, is still operating in a world of its own where the Palestine issue is concerned, completely isolated from the realities of the Middle East and under one-sided pressure to take what are described as pro-Israeli positions that are not, in my view, even in Israel's long-term interests. Why is occupation in Israel's interest? Why are settlements in Israel's interest? The Israeli people don't support these things. Why is our Congress enabling these things, I ask myself. It is long past time for people in this country who see the illogic of America's stance, whether it's in Iraq or whether it's in Palestine, to organize and to lobby effectively for balanced and rational policies that will help to calm the situation in this part of the world instead of exacerbating it as our current policy does. I hope all of you agree with me. I hope all of you will exert every effort to this end. And these things are all connected. I assure you that if this administration is not effectively checked by the people and their representatives, it is perfectly capable, it's going to be there for another 2.5 years, and it is perfectly capable of making an already hideous situation for U.S. interests in Palestine and Iraq even worse, and it is moreover capable of plunging us even further into chaos with an attack on Iran. Only we, the people, can prevent this march of folly. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'll sit down and take questions. That's much fun.
Thank you very much. We will take questions, and I'm going to have to repeat the questions before Rashid answers. Now, is your mic that you have on?
My mic is working.
Right. Okay, fine. So we're fine like this.
Yeah.
Well, why don't I go 1, 2, 3, 4? I'll make a diamond shape in the first row. I'm going to have to repeat your question, so if you want to. The question is...
Why don't you repeat the question, then we'll take a couple more.
Okay, we'll take several questions, 2 or 3 questions, and then Rashid will answer them as a group. So the first question is, given the unlikelihood of complete Israeli withdrawal from the settlement and Hamas's insistence on complete withdrawal, what does Professor Khalidi think of an alternative proposal that has come out of a Palestinian alternative agenda? Is that fair? All right, I said I would take the gentleman in the red shirt. The question regards how Israel's policies of continuing settlements and occupation can continue to exist over majorities of Israeli public opinion that are opposed to that. Elisa Becker? The question is whether Abbas can be a negotiator with Omert as opposed to trying to get a Hamas-Israeli government dialogue going.
Mm-hmm. Shall I answer those three? Shall I go up there?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me answer them in order. Considering that Israel will not get out of the settlements, Hamas demands that it leave them all. What about a binational state? There are a couple problems with a binational state. The first is most Israelis don't want it, and the second is most Palestinians don't want it. Aside from that, it has a lot of merit. Because how to partition Palestine has not been an easy riddle to solve, nor in the 30s, nor in the 40s, nor today. On the other hand, you have very strong majorities on both sides who still want their own separate independent state. I'm loath to predict how this thing will go. A lot of people argue, as I do, that it may well be that the time for a two-state solution is past. I mean, Meron Benvenisti has been saying this since the 70s, former deputy mayor of Jerusalem. The time for a two-state solution is past simply because the facts that have been established on the ground over the past 3.5 decades make the creation of a separate, viable, contiguous Palestinian state impossible. On the other hand, you have these aspirations of Palestinians and Israelis. If there is to be a binational state, it will only pass through a great deal of anguish on both sides. I'm not necessarily talking about conflict. I'm talking about anguish, because it will involve both giving up what they see as, you know, important aspirations for separate nationhood. But maybe in the end it will be a solution. I couldn't even speculate on that. The question here about, I repeated that most Israelis do not support the occupation. Why is it that the government continues with it? Well, you know, democracies are strange things, and Israel is nothing if not a democracy. Most of us don't support the war in Iraq, do we? Have our elected representatives risen up on their hind legs to do anything about that? No. Has our president perceived that he has 29% approval? No. Has he changed his policy? No. Is he going to? I doubt it. Did British public opinion support the Labour government's support of our war in Iraq? No. Did Blair support our war? Yes. Did Spanish, Italian? I could go on and on and on. So what's important is looking at the political forces, which is actually why I started with Labour, Kadima, Likud, and why I started with Fatah and Hamas. Part of the problem in Israel is that certainly since the end of the 90s, when everybody on both sides thought the peace had already arrived, when in fact it hadn't even been negotiated between the two sides, since then, and since the beginning of the Second Intifada, the political basis for a resolute opposition to the occupation and a resolute opposition to settlements has basically evaporated. Israeli public opinion was driven far to the right by the Second Intifada. And the settlement movement took advantage of that. But there is an institutional process at work of the security establishment. The occupation itself involves a huge element of Israel's economy, a huge element of the Israeli government, rather like our military-industrial complex goes on like a bulldozer, like a moloch. Whatever we say, whatever we do, it just goes on and on and on. We have hundreds of bases around the world. Do we want them as Americans? Do we need them? Is this something that is in our national interest? Questions that are never asked. Do we need this weapon system, that weapon system, this other weapon system designed in the 80s to fight a Soviet army that has rusted and disappeared? Questions that are never asked. Similarly, the whole mechanism of control which Israel has instituted over these 39 years now has developed a life of its own and a justification of its own. I was struck today as I came down listening on BEZ to a report that the new defense minister, Amir Peretz, has ordered the military to open the Karni crossing, has ordered that more Palestinians be allowed to go from the West Bank to work in Israel, workers as well as businessmen. And the commentators who were asked, Hirsch Goodman and other people, Yaron Ezrahi and others, said, well, he's going to come up against a great deal of opposition on this. So we're going to see. Here is a politician who actually campaigned on a platform of he wanted negotiations, he wants to end the occupation, and so on. We'll see the extent to which he's going to be able to make a go of it. He will be going up against the fact that he's not a general, and they are always poo-pooing his lack of expertise. Well, the generals have led Israel into this mess. You would think that Israelis would say, just as we might say, maybe this government has not done so well in Iraq, and maybe we should think about changing course. Hopefully, Israelis will be able to see the same thing. Unfortunately, Israelis are normal people. If there are further attacks, heaven forbid, just as if there are, heaven forbid, further attacks in this country, people who use fear to drive people to do things will exploit that. The Bush administration can do nothing else right but exploit fear. It doesn't seem to be able to do much else properly, whether in New Orleans, whether in the CIA, whether anywhere else. But they sure know how to scare us. Unfortunately, it's not just the Bush administration that does that. Last question about the possibility of negotiations. You know, it takes two to tango. It takes both Hamas and Fatah on the Palestinian side, but it also takes the whole Israeli government. Amir Peretz, the Minister of Defense, the number two guy in the government, on the Israeli side, has argued that Israel should do this. I forget who asked the question. Elisa back there, right. And certainly Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, has argued that this should happen. But it will take the Olmert side, the dominant side of that coalition, and it will take Hamas agreeing before the two sides can sit down. And I think we have a little ways to go. And I think that our government's policies are actually retarding rather than facilitating that process.
So it actually takes four to tango.
It takes four, that's right.
I'm going to take several questions from the back of the room. We'll take three more. And we'll go, the two people right in a row, the woman with her hand up Yeah, you with the blonde hair, and then the man right behind her, and then the gentleman standing way at the back who's had his hand up for a while. Jennifer Binkinar's question regards the effects of the humanitarian crisis and the extent of the humanitarian crisis now ongoing. The next question, yeah. I still have to repeat the question, even though you can hear it. Professor Khalidi's asked for his opinion on the recent John Mearsheimer and, who's the other author, Stephen Walt piece in the London Review of Books. The question is, what changed under Abu Mazen following Arafat's death, and why did Hamas come in?
Should we take those three? Is that it? Okay. Three good questions again. I love coming to Chicago. You all ask such good questions. About the humanitarian crisis. Well, the humanitarian crisis is a direct result of our policy, partly because the United States has forced the various donors to withhold the money which, on the basis of which the Palestinian Authority functions. And partly, secondly, because Israel has frozen the delivery of Palestinian money collected from Palestinians or from Palestinian customs, which it's obliged by treaty to hand over to the PA. But largely because of our anti-terrorism laws. They are written in such a way that if an organization or a state is listed on this terrorist list, any transactions with that organization or that state are illegal, and you are liable to prosecution for aiding and abetting a terrorist. So Hamas, which of course has carried out numerous terrorist attacks, by which I mean attacks on civilians, is on the terrorist list. But Hamas is now in charge of the PA. And the PA is a government established in large part by international and Israeli efforts. It's not a sovereign government, it doesn't have jurisdiction, doesn't have control, but it carries out a variety of functions, education, health, welfare, infrastructure, and so forth, without which you're going to have a major humanitarian crisis. In addition to cutting off the funding, the United States has been bludgeoning the United Nations, bludgeoning NGOs, and basically preventing anybody from transferring funds in any way, and going to the banks, the office of OFAC, what's OFAC? Office of Foreign Asset Control in the Treasury, has played a glorious role in this, basically mugging any bank that dares to consider carrying out any transfers to the PA. What this means is that there is almost no way to get money into the occupied territories. And now that this bill is up for consideration, the one that someone mentioned may come to vote next week, it may be even worse. Even private transfers, not to the PA, will be subject to the same kind of draconian law. The result, as you can imagine, in a highly developed economy, this is not a rich country, but it is a highly developed country. There are ATMs all over the place. People put their money in banks. They use shekels, but you know, it's a Palestinian economy which is largely dependent on Israel, but which has a kind of existence of its own. It is being basically starved to death, the whole economy. And with it, this society is under enormous pressure. Now, it's a society that has all kinds of social solidarity networks that have enabled it to survive under the pressure it's already under. But you can push a society just so far. And if this continues, you will be pushing it beyond that point. The Mearsheimer-Walt article. The question was about the controversy. I'll say two things about this. I forget who it was who said that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels.
Dr. Johnson?
Was it really? Dr. Johnson, our resident English expert, has illuminated me as he many times has done before. It is Dr. Johnson who said that politics is the last refuge of scoundrels. Now, I'm going to take that somewhere else. There is a serious problem in many parts of the world with anti-Semitism. The Hamas charter, for example, is notoriously anti-Semitic. There is a resurgence of certain kinds of anti-Semitism in Russia and other parts of the world. But quite frequently, I think you will find that people who use the accusation of anti-Semitism to throttle public debate are, in fact, scoundrels. And I think that this is the case here. I think the people who have argued that what John Mearsheimer and Steve Walt did was in any way, manner, or form anti-Semitic are doing two really terrible things. They're trying to throttle public debate, but even worse than that, they're debasing what should be a very serious accusation of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is not an illusory problem. It has been one of the greatest problems. It was one of the greatest problems of the 20th century. It still exists. To talk about a legitimate contribution to a public debate on a vital issue of national policy in terms of anti-Semitism is disgraceful. And the people who have done this should be ashamed of themselves. I can't say any more. The second thing I'll say is that I think that as, again, the good Dr. Chandler pointed this out to me in his analysis. I'm sorry, I'm going to quote you again, Jim. I think to some extent, at least John Mearsheimer, to some extent, expected some of this reaction. And when he said there is going to be a huge reaction, and anybody who says these things is accused of anti-Semitism, and there was a huge reaction,